got into very formal aspects of quantum mechanics and was very good at it, from my understanding. But yes, he left structural chemistry of natural products, and I think he did that because a lot of the romance and glamour was going out of the field with the advent of the X-ray crystallographers, and so he didn't find that terribly challenging anymore, and so he drifted off into this other area.
Not so you used to argue with him about
about chemistry. I mean, he had very strong ideas about things that, in some instances, he knew a lot more about than I did. But I was, it took me a while to realize that. And that he was trying to convince me of these things, and I was resisting. but in fact, he was a very smart guy, and I enjoyed being with him because I learned a lot from him. Other people from that era that I remember, Gene Van Tamelen was around, and I guess I knew him slightly. He was in Stork's group. And another fellow, Al Bergstaller, who was with Stork at that time. So, all these people went to Kansas, yeah. All these people became professors. Soon after leaving Harvard.
Yeah. The breeding ground.
Yeah, sure. That was where the action was. So it was a very good experience. And in an area where, as I say, I started out knowing very little, I learned a tremendous amount there about natural products and so on. But then, when I got to, well, you want to talk about
how did you get the job?
How I got the job. Yeah, well, that's an interesting story too. those in those days, the jobs were not announced, almost entirely done by the old boy network, and so sometimes belatedly. I would hear about them. Sometimes I didn't hear about them at all, and then it would come to my attention that so and so got a job at such and such a place. I'd say, "What? I didn't even know there was a job there." So I got into the mode of writing letters, you know. And somebody told me I should write letters to the department chair at these places, or to famous chemists at these places, and offer my services. And I did that. I wrote about 60 letters that year.
So by then you had decided that you wanted to be an academic.
Absolutely, absolutely. But we'll come back to that point in a minute. But it was clear that if I wanted to do work like Woodward and Stork and those people and have a lab of my own and work on ideas of my own, that I would only be able to do that in academic work and industrial work. Place was not a good venue for that kind of lifestyle. So I began to write these letters. I wrote 60 letters, and I got back a uniform response. When they answered, most of them did answer. They answered very politely. Nowadays, you probably might not get an answer, but they answered very politely. But they all said, in one way or another, they said no. That and some of them even offered excuses. So what I came away with was 60, a collection of approximately 60, maybe a few fewer, but letters from some very significant, famous, in some instances, chemists. I have autograph signatures of all these wonderful people, Linus Pauling, you know, telling me that they didn't have a job for me.
By that time, did you think that there was, well, maybe not an academia, anti-Semitic problems?
I wondered about that.
And certainly wasn't still an industry, I think.
Oh, there certainly was. There certainly was, and there certainly was in academic life, too. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. But the more important point is whether I felt... discriminated against because of my background. And I have to say honestly that I did not then, and in retrospect people have told me I was naive, but I don't think so. I don't think so. Because, I mean, there were guys, I mean, Ernie Wenkert got a job. Jerry Meinwald got a job, and I'm trying to think of some of the other people who were Jewish background who got jobs. Now, Jerry tells me that his job was really kind of a backdoor thing because he was not appointed. He was appointed as some kind of a visiting instructor, and then an opening opened up, and he was there, and they saw his quality, and so they kept him on.
Did Ernie go to Iowa State at that time?
Yeah, because I think so.
He used to attend our shul in Des Moines on high holidays.
And yeah.
I think he closed down his laboratory on Friday afternoon.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
He teaches courses on Sunday morning.
And yeah.
This is the middle of Iowa.
Yeah, know. Right. No, he was quite serious.
Yeah.
And so you know, I found it very difficult to accept the idea that I was being discriminated against. I mean, I think you're going to have other excuses that I was not as experienced as these people in natural products chemistry, and Woodward probably thought of me as a little naive about this and maybe not ready, and I guess I was aware of this at the time. He never told me that, and I had no external reason.
I mean, he knew you were looking for a job.
Certainly, he knew, and he wrote letters for me, and Bill Daring did. Well, so things got pretty late in the recruiting season, and I was not having any luck. And I heard again through the rumor mill that there was a job in Max Tischler's lab at Merck. And I said, "Well, okay, it's not an academic job, but it's a good group. They're doing basic research. Why don't I try to see whether I can get a job there?" So I applied, and I asked Woodward to write a letter for me, which he did, and I received an offer for an interview from Max Tischler, and I went down to Merck, and I spent the day there. And at the end of the day, Max called me in. Max was a real, you know, the word is a mensch. He was a mensch. He was a straightforward guy and no nonsense, and he was very blunt with me. He said, "Look, you made a good impression here. I don't want you to think that we're rejecting you for cause. But the thing that worries me is the same thing that worried Woodward when he wrote his letter on your behalf. And that is, he thinks that you want an academic job. And I think you do too. And I think that's what you really would be happiest doing. And I'm just not going to make you an offer now until I have evidence that you are convinced and dedicated to a career in industrial research," which was a very straightforward answer, and did not surprise me at all. So I really had come to the end of my rope. I didn't know what to do then, and I was pondering about whether I should start writing letters to industrial companies since I'd covered the waterfront of the academic field, every department in the country. I hadn't written to some places that, you know, I would not think of going to, but pretty much every substantial chemistry department in the country I'd covered. So I was about to get started on my campaign for an industrial job, and I got a call from Bill Daring in the lab. We didn't have a phone in the lab, so I had to go out in the hall to answer him, and he started to chew me out. He said, "How could you even think of taking an industrial job? Don't you have any pride? Don't you have any sense?" I mean, it was really a tongue lashing. And I said, "Well, I really don't have any alternatives. I've tried all the places, and nobody wants me, and so." I have to do something. How am I going to eat next year? And he said, "Well, I think you should try an industrial, you try to get an academic job again next year. And I said, well, that's fine, except that my fellowship runs out this year. And he says, well, I'm going to talk to Woodward, and why don't you talk to Woodward first about this, see if he can't keep you on for another year. So I did, and Woodward didn't make any promises. He obviously was very reluctant to do this. And finally then, I heard from Doering that Woodward had changed his mind. I think because Doering twisted his arm. And so Woodward made me an offer for another year's postdoc on his funds, since my NRC fellowship had expired. Well, this was around March or April, I guess it was. Now, what I had forgotten completely about was that there had been one advertised job that year. It was at the University of Southern California. They were advertising for an organic chemist who wanted to carry out a research program in natural products chemistry and organic synthesis. So I presumed to try to pass myself off as a natural products chemist. And I applied for this job. I'd completely forgotten about it because so much time had gone by, I hadn't heard from these people.
But, I mean, you weren't passing yourself off. You really weren't.
Well, I was trying to be, let's put it that way.
Of sorts.
That was my claim. That was I was either that or nothing, because
okay.
Anyway, so I'd applied for this job, rather not hoping very much that I would get it, but then I got a telegram from Anton Berg, who was the chairman at that time. I'd never had an interview. I'd never met any of those people. But offering me a job. The telegram had the salary they wanted to pay me, when they wanted me to report to work, and I have to let them know immediately. So, that was my academic offer for the year, and instead of staying on for another year with Woodward, I mulled this over for a long time. I talked to Doering about it, and he said, well, you probably should take it. It's a chance at an academic job. You'll get started and see how it goes. So that's where I ended up, and I was there for 13 years.
So
it wasn't so bad. It was.
So what was it like when you got there?
Well, it was.
I mean, you've never seen the department.
I've never seen it.
I took a job exactly the same way, so I don't know about you. I didn't have an interview. I was on the West Coast. They hired me on the East Coast.
Yeah.
I was in England when I got hired to teach in Worcester.
So it's sight unseen. That's the way they used to do it. And okay, so fine. I did have to send them a photograph, and I remember that. So they wanted to make sure that I was human, I guess. But in any case, I got out there, and it was a very interesting situation. I was allowed to have a lab office combination for myself. Now, that meant a small basement lab below ground level with a desk in it. The desk was my office. And there was a hood in there, and that was my lab. And it was about, I would say, about 10 feet by 10 feet altogether. Maybe. So, but by the time you got the desk in there, there wasn't a hell of a lot of room, let's put it that way. Anyway, and I could have one other lab down in the basement, or if I wanted more space, I was free to go down the street two blocks outside the chemistry building to an old converted wooden barracks building, which was where they taught the undergraduate organic labs. And where I was supposed to be supervising those labs as part of my teaching obligation the first time I was there. And I could have more space there. I could have a bigger office, and I could have a lot more lab space. Well, that office and lab was two blocks away from the main chemistry building, from the stock room, from the library, from other chemists. You know, what was I going to do out there? So I decided to stay in the main building in the basement. And within about 2 years, the fire department condemned all the barracks buildings at USC, that all the ones that had chemistry labs in them, and said, you've got to have a building to put these in because these are a terrible fire hazard. And so they built what was then called the organic wing, which was a small concrete and brick building, which I was allowed to have an office, and more like a real office, with an adjoining lab, a separate lab, and space for a few students. I don't remember how many I was given space for, but I didn't have many anyway, so it didn't make much difference. So that was the beginning, really, of serious research at USC.
The first couple of publications were, in fact, on structure, but within 2 or 3 years, you started to publish. And you published a number of papers on
mechanisms. Yeah.
Cis-bromination of bicyclic volatile emissions. Mm-hmm. A lot of work with somebody by the name of R. Swidler.
Ron Swidler. Yeah, it was my first graduate student. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, very good man.
So, you know, tell us how you...
Well, so time went on, and what became clear to me... I mean, the thing that really sort of the straw that broke the camel's back was that I was trying to synthesize the alkaloid emetine at that time. That had been a project... It was related to the project I worked on with Woodward. When I came to Woodward, I wanted to work on emetine. I wanted to work on the structure of emetine, which then had not been fully elucidated. But I didn't have any very good ideas about it, and I look back and marvel about how Woodward was able to euchre me out of that crazy project, because I would have botched it and it wouldn't have come to anything. And he put me into this other thing, which he thought was more... an achievable objective in the time that I had there. So, but the total synthesis of emetine itself was something that I had not considered undertaking until after I'd been in Woodward's lab. And by then I thought that, well, perhaps I had some ideas about how this could be approached. And so the first person to in my lab who worked on that was Ted Cohen, who was now a professor at Pittsburgh. And Ted worked on the preliminary stages of this plan for putting together the structure of emetine. In the meantime, several other labs were working on it, and midway through the work of successor students to Ted, we got scooped 2 or 3 times, so... You know, you can't do this kind of work one graduate student at a time, which is what I had. So, well, Ted did some very nice work in the preliminary stages of this and really set the whole thing up, and it was ready to be continued by another student. We published several papers on this, including some mechanistic work, because that was very interesting.
Who was funding this at this time? USC?
Basically. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any money. Eventually, you know, the National Science Foundation didn't begin until 1951.
There was other government money.
There was Navy.
Money.
Yeah, I wasn't able to get any of that. I wasn't able to get NIH money either until later. But at the very beginning, there was, I mean, the pharmaceutical companies were nowhere in sight. They were not out there funding, not me anyway. And
it probably didn't cost a lot to...
I had some chemicals. We didn't get an NMR spectrometer. An infrared. But then we didn't get an NMR until 1962, which was the year before I left. So there was a lag, instrumental lag there, but...
The department was, I don't know,
it must have been somewhere, faculty or somewhere in the 20s. There were four organic chemists. There was myself, Norman Karash, Ronald Brown, and Milton Kletzel. Those are the four organic chemists.
And who was the last one?
Kletzel, K-L-O-E-T-Z-E-L. Nobody else was doing natural products work, and nobody in the whole Southern California area was really doing natural products work of the Woodward Stork style. I mean, there was Sechmeister at Caltech, but it was very narrowly focused on pigments, plant pigments and chromatography.
That's true. That was one of the real centers of physical organic.
Absolutely, it was.
Were you going to seminars?
Mecca. That's a very good point. That's a very good point. So time went on, and it was clear that I was getting my head bloody in this total synthesis game. I couldn't compete with the big research groups. One of the groups that scooped me was Arnold Brussy's group at Hoffman La Roche. He published a paper with, I don't know, a half a dozen authors on it that cleaned this whole thing up. And we hadn't even gotten off first base. So it gradually became clear to me that this was not the way that I was going to be able to do chemical research. I could not, with the resources, the manpower resources at my disposal, I was not going to be able to do natural products research. I mean, I had something like 7 PhDs in the 13 years I was at USC. That's all the students I had. So I was always manpower deprived. I began to try to recruit postdocs, and to some extent I was able to. Some of them were good, some were lousy, some were worse than lousy, and it was not a successful enterprise, largely because of the student problem. And the student problem was exacerbated by the fact that there were already two major centers of organic chemical research in the area, at Caltech and particularly at UCLA. And anybody who wanted to do physical organic chemistry was going to go to UCLA, and not USC. So I had some good students, I don't deny that. I mean, Swidler was very good, Ted Cohen was very good, Earlene Brown was a very good student. I really shouldn't complain too much, but there weren't very many of them. So I gradually began to sort of realize that the people whose work I admired in natural products were also good physical organic chemists. They used this kind of discipline in their own work, and Woodward is a prime example, but also Stork and Derek Barton, and there were a number of people of that type who clearly were at home in the subject and could make profitable use of it in their own research. And I began to wonder whether I couldn't begin to handle physical organic problems with the resources that I realistically had at my disposal. There's one student, one problem, or maybe some very small number of students on a problem. So that began to shift over to that style, and although I had sporadically attended the UCLA seminars from very early on, I began to attend them religiously. In fact, I was sort of a nuisance over there. And every Thursday night we had this knockdown, drag out very intense seminar, and Saul Winstein was in the leadership of that, and gosh, he was a very strong influence on me. It was like having a 13-year postdoc to be around that guy. He was so deep. He just would not let you get away with anything. And I would say that if I learned anything about physical organic chemistry, he certainly was at the heart of it. That the approach to the subject, the way you had to let your mind work, the kinds of things that you had to always be concerned about, were really for the first time made clear to me in Saul's seminars and in personal discussions with him. He was not an easy guy to get to know, but I will flatter myself to say that before I left the Southern California area, I was almost a friend of his. We spoke the same language, and he took me seriously. Well, for one reason, because I sided with him in this non-classical ion controversy, but not only because of that. I don't think he sought my opinion, but he took the trouble to explain to me where his opinion came from. And that was truly a tremendous, tremendous experience for me. So I'll always be grateful to Saul. And Don Cram was also very receptive, very open, very warm guy, and had good relations with him. And so that was where I gravitated. Jack Roberts came over occasionally. George Hammond came occasionally, especially later on, when he came to Caltech, he would come not every week, but frequently, I would say. So it was a good, lively group, and there were lots of pretty intense discussions, and some people came out kind of bloodied after a seminar given to that group.
Were you there when Herb Brown visited?
Oh, yeah. But that was not at the Thursday night seminar. That was a special seminar they had, and this was the time when Herb was going around the country propagandizing for his view of those observations, and it got to be very rancorous. That his seminar got to be very rancorous, because it was soon after this fiasco, which took place, I guess it was at an ACS meeting in Houston, in which Herb presented data which Saul and Jack Roberts subsequently accused him of knowing was incorrect. And Saul stood up and accused him of that, and right at the meeting, and said that those data are incorrect, and you know it, Herb. And then Herb Brown, shortly after that, came out to the Southern California area, and he spoke at Caltech, and he said the same thing at Caltech, and that part is written up
in Jack's
autobiography.
Yeah.
But he came to UCLA, and I'm trying to remember. I think he did not say that at UCLA, because I'm not sure he was certain of getting out of there alive. But it was a very rancorous discussion period.
I talked to a guy who had been a grad student at UCLA.
Yeah.
Who was at that seminar, and he said he was kind of shocked.
Well, it was. I mean, Don Cram brought in a collection of his reprints, and
his being heard?
No, of Don's reprints, and he was leafing through them, and you could see his ears getting redder and redder because of what Herb had said about Don's work and Don's interpretation of these things. At the end of the seminar, Don stood up in a trembling voice, and he opened up this book, and he said, you are insulting the work of my students. Years of effort went into this. How can you say what you're saying? And he was in tears. It was really a shocking thing. So, you could argue the pros and cons of the scientific aspects of this, but there's no doubt that there were very, very deep feelings involved. And the reasons for that, well, I think that it would take a psychiatrist to figure that out.